people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Claire Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the US Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And she's one of the three recipients of the 2010 Awards for Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her latest book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Claire Pascal.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
And Claire, there have been long and sustained demonstrations in front of the White House, culminating this last weekend, and various activists led by Bill McKibben have been arrested for protesting the proposed pipeline that will take tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, through a pipeline to be built across the United States down to refineries in Texas. And I believe these demonstrations are going to move now to Canada. So I'd like to get a Canadian perspective on this. What is the attitude that you can glean from the Canadian press and from your colleagues about this controversy over this pipeline?
It depends on the sector that you're in and your background and where you live and how much a part of the system you feel. So obviously, in the oil patch, there's quite a bit of excitement about it. Canada has been hit, like many other G8 countries, by the financial downturn. So, anything that's a boost to that sort of economy is seen as very welcome. However, if you happen to live in that area and are already being affected by some of the pollution that's resulting, and especially the water contamination, then there's a lot of concern. Also, in the First Nations communities that are disproportionately affected already by the effluents from the process that's being used, this becomes almost a sovereignty issue. And for others, it's there's kind of consolation taken, at least it won't be refined here. That dirty bit of the industry will be sent down to the U.S. So it really depends on where you're coming at it from. Canada is a very big country, and it's very regional. So if you're in eastern Canada, I'm currently in Montreal, you feel you won't be affected by the pollution. If you're in the west, you feel like you will. So depending on your proximity, your emotions are going to be a lot higher.
And I take it this new Canadian Prime Minister, who was elected with less than 50% of the vote, nevertheless feels he has a mandate, and I take it he's totally in support of this pipeline.
Yeah, Prime Minister Harper's base of power is in Alberta for economic reasons, but also for social reasons. Alberta is sometimes called the kind of Texas of Canada. Tends to be a little bit more conservative, a little bit more free market oriented. So that's his base of power, and his constituents and the constituents of many of his elected MPs will be supporting this. So from a political perspective, it makes a lot of sense to him. My concern is that currently the cost of the water that is being contaminated isn't being put into the economic analysis. So this idea that this is an economic boom for Canada, or even just for one part of Canada, I think is false economics. We've been discounting the loss associated with the contamination of large amounts of fresh water. And, especially if you're in California, you know fresh water has value. And here we are just throwing it away in the production of the oil. Now, you can manufacture other energy sources, but manufacturing fresh water requires energy. So it seems like a bit of a false economy to be saying that, you know, this is a good deal. I'm quite concerned about the loss of vast amounts of fresh water because we'll need it for agriculture, urban development, and other forms of industrialization.
But Cleo Pascal, surely it's not just losing water, it is creating an enormous and growing a pond, if you will, of contaminated water that won't go away.
That's right. And this is, there's kind of the idea that Canada is an unending spring of fresh water, but the vast majority of water in Canada is what's called fossil water. It's water that was left over from the receding glaciers. This will not be replenished once it's gone or contaminated. So, you know, already the U.S. is starting to look up towards Canada as a potential fresh water supply, but that water is being contaminated. And as you say, you know, once it's gone, it's gone. So, again, even from a straightforward free market economics perspective, even the, you know, the kind of most gung-ho right-wing oil guy, if they're forced to do honest accounting of the cost associated with extracting this oil, you'll find that the economics really just don't bear scrutiny. They don't. If you look at what it's costing in terms of all the externalities, like contamination of water, cleanup costs, all this sort of stuff, in many cases, this is a loss to the economy and a loss that will hit other critical sectors like agriculture, urban development, healthcare costs for those that are affected.
Again, I'm speaking with Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House in London, a consultant to the US Department of Energy, NATO and the OSCE, and the author of Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Now, the picture that Bill McKibben, who was arrested in front of the White House and led this demonstration that just concluded on the weekend but will now apparently move to Canada, he told me that already the vast pond up there in Alberta that's full of this contaminated water, the water is used to extract the sand from the tar. And, of course, it becomes brackish and permanently polluted. And it's stored in this vast pond that's already bigger than the Aswan Dam and will presumably grow bigger and bigger as this these tar sands get exploited. He described it as Mordor. Now, in Canada, are people aware of this vast blight on the land?
There's been some coverage of it. It's not front and center, I think, in the vast majority of people's thinking. I mean, again, here I'm in Quebec. We're probably just as far away from the area as California is. It's one of those things where if it doesn't affect you directly, you may not be thinking about it, unfortunately. The media has not been fabulous about looking at the complexities of this debate. But of course, if you're there, you know, you know it, or if you have relatives that have been affected by it. And this has the potential to spill out into a larger security concern because the First Nations communities, which again are disproportionately being affected by these pollutants, are convinced that it's causing cancers and birth defects, and it is directly affecting their community, and they feel like the federal government isn't responding. Now, this may or may not be accurate, but this is how they feel. That is from a security perspective, national security perspective, very dangerous situation because you already have outreach from China, for example, to First Nations communities in Canada. And part of the pitch of China is, look, your federal government doesn't really care about you. You should start looking towards China as an economic partner. You know, and you have to remember that about a third of Canada's land mass is owned or controlled through land claim settlements by First Nations communities. They potentially have a lot of power, which, you know, would be, you know, good to see them, you know, using and stewarding in a way that is really beneficial towards their communities. But also, that gives them quite a bit of potential foreign policy leverage if they decide to go down that route. Now, up until now, the communities have been, there's been a lot of internal dissent. They've been on the receiving end of a lot of policies. They haven't really been driving policy to that degree. But if things are getting so bad that they feel like they really are being dispossessed and they're not a part of the federal system, then they might find those sorts of overtures from a country like China very attractive. Now, that's a failure on the part of the Canadian federal government not to address these concerns before they get to the point where people become so disenfranchised they look towards other options.
But my understanding is that there is also a plan or proposal in the works to build a pipeline from the Alberta tar sands through to the Pacific coast to ship this stuff to China. And
that's right.
My understanding is it may not be an either or. In other words, if President Obama vetoes this pipeline and it's his decision alone, the State Department already approved it. And clearly the environmentalists are this is a kind of line in the sand, and not to use an obvious pun there.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily an either or. I mean, it's possible that the pipeline will be built to the Pacific coast no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, even if the oil does end up going through the pipeline down to the Gulf of Mexico, that oil, once refined, may be sold on to China as well. I mean, this doesn't necessarily go towards dealing with domestic U.S. lack of supply. You know, so, I mean, this is economics. This isn't national security. Now, if it was straight-up national security, if this was oil that was definitely going to be used in the U.S. system, that's potentially, you know, another issue, another sort of thing to debate. But it's not. It's commercial. So, but the China component isn't necessarily just from the point of view of supply. There's another pipeline in British Columbia that's been bombed 6 times. Now, they still haven't caught the bomber, but the letters that go into the newspaper, the anonymous letters that go into the newspaper, you know, say that it's an environmental attack, and that there's concern over the effect of this on the communities, of the pipelines on the communities. And so there's actually have been bombings. Now, if you start to get a population that's so disaffected and so desperate and is being encouraged from outside forces, you have a potentially very unstable situation. So the concerns of the local population, you know, it's not just an environmental issue. You know, even if you're the hardest edge type of person, you need to address this strictly from a national security perspective.
Well, but from an economic and commercial perspective,
yeah.
I find it difficult to understand how this oil is practical unless the price of oil stays high. And my understanding is that it's very likely to stay high. There have been a lot of indications that the price of oil in this country is largely artificial, pushed up through speculation on Wall Street.
Yeah.
The Saudis, on the other hand, apparently, because they're so afraid of the Arab Spring, they need about $100 a barrel oil to get the money to buy off the younger generation so that they don't take to the streets. So
they also took a bath during the financial crisis. So, you know, there was a major loss in the trillions, you know, from the Middle East on the financial crisis. So not only is it kind of a lot of the financial reserves are gone. The sovereign wealth funds are a lot smaller than they used to be. So that's also a component of why they feel there needs to be a consistent high flow of cash.
So, but how could it be? I mean, ExxonMobil running ads here on American television promoting the tar sands, and
yeah.
I just don't understand the economics of it, because you're saying they're not factoring in the water pollution and the use of water, which once they use it for this process, it's absolutely useless. It becomes a vast pond of pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you apparently need natural gas to heat the water and also to heat the tar so that it'll flow through the pipes.
Mm-hmm.
Those costs have to be factored in.
Well, but they aren't because of the economic structures that we've set up consider many things like the water pollution externalities. So it distorts the accounting. It's perfectly legal and it's considered kind of standard, but it is distortion. It's the same thing that allows you know, BP to self-insure its rig in the Gulf when the private sector says, we're not going to touch it, it's way too dangerous. You know, there are kind of all these mechanisms that have been set up that allow you to discount risk, right, or to discount real cost. And I'm using the term discount in a mathematical sense. And from the point of view of a company like Exxon, their growth model, you know, they need to grow, look like it's like they're visibly growing on a quarterly basis because of the way their financial structure is set up. So in the case of BP going into the Arctic, for example, you know, that deal fell through, but when they were signing the deal, they got bumps in stock prices because it looked like they would be, you know, having access to Arctic oil. So in many cases, the thinking, the economic thinking from the oil and gas sector is, you know, how will this affect this quarter and how can we discount all of these risks and what can we consider externalities? So you have a distorted economic system. And that's what allows these sorts of decisions to be made and to look like, and in fact, in the context in which they're operating, they are good decisions. They are rational decisions. But when you look in the context of reality, they make absolutely no sense. They make as much sense as building a nuclear power station in an earthquake zone.
And that hasn't happened, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think you're probably within a few hundred miles of one, actually.
Sure. So Cleo Pascal, when the chief scientist at NASA, Dr. Hansen, in reference to this Keystone pipeline that's proposed to be built from the tar sands of Alberta to the oil refineries in Texas across the United States, he says that once that oil is refined in Texas, it's game over for the environment. And I think he's referring in terms of global warming because of the high sulfur content. Is that your understanding? That it's
I don't think I'm qualified to make a scientific assessment of that.
Right. Well,
However, I do know that it's not being incorporated into the economic assessment. I mean, that particular environmental cost is not being factored into the economics of the project. I wouldn't know how to quantify that economic cost. Mm-hmm. That would take smarter people than me.
It's clearly a different mix. It's the it's got to be pretty difficult. I mean, I don't know what the percentage of gas you can get out of it, and what the byproducts are, and whether or not you're going to have more sulfur in the air. I just don't know what model Hansen is using.
I don't know either. But I mean, I would be equally concerned about the fact that about 30% of U.S. refining capacity is along the U.S. Gulf Coast, which is an area that, as we know, is prone to subsidence, flooding, hurricanes, you know, major environmental instability. So, you know, it's only a matter of time before we keep getting these, you know, get more hits that is going to create spills in that area. So even without the Keystone pipeline, we have a very serious problem with environmental instability and its effect on the energy sector. You know, they've just shut down the Gulf Coast platforms again because of the storm that's rolling in now. We're starting to get increased disruptions to Gulf Coast offshore oil and gas platforms because of storm activity. Katrina destroyed over 100 oil and gas platforms in the U.S. Gulf Coast. So, you know, that we already have enormous oil and gas infrastructure in very vulnerable locations. And that needs to be addressed. You know, we can try to head off the future ones that look kind of not good bets. And ideally do it through proper accounting and, you know, proper market mechanisms, not distorting the market through subsidies and allowing real risk to affect decision-making. But we also need to look at what we already have there, because what we already have is incredibly dangerous.
Well, again, Cleo Pascal, the author of Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. And just in closing, since you've written about the projecting forward what global warming will do to change the world, change the map, open up the Northwest Passage, among other things, clearly you're talking about something that's real. And one of the things that's extraordinary about this disconnect here is that one of the big boosters of this pipeline, who is the candidate, presidential candidate of the oil business, is Governor Perry of Texas. And he had to postpone his appearance on a Republican presidential debate in order to go down and deal with the unprecedented wildfires now in Texas. And it just strikes me as such an extraordinary irony that a man who wants to be president of the United States, who denies global warming, is nevertheless now talking about the most unprecedented fires that he's ever seen in his state and not making the connection.
Yeah, no, it's tragic. And it's not only climate change. It's the way we are changing the environment through building in areas we shouldn't be building in, through land management use that's just dangerous, through depletion of aquifer. You know, we're being hit on all sides. You know, climate change is you know, like steroids to the system, but already, you know, the way that we've changed the environment would be dangerous on its own. So, you know, anybody that thinks that they can afford it, you know, just to keep absorbing the hits is living in a fantasy land. I mean, the U.S. is broke, right? You can't keep paying off the National Flood Insurance Program, you know, when you keep building million-dollar condos on the coast of Florida and knowing that they're in a hurricane zone. I mean, it's insane. So, you know, it was interesting what President Obama did during Irene. I mean, he clearly knows that politically, if you don't deal with a disaster, you're dead. So we'll see, as these guys have to deal with disaster after disaster after disaster, whether they're willing to be proactive in order to get around their own demise by not dealing inappropriately with the consequences.
Well, we'll have to stay in touch, and you may be getting an influx of refugees from the United States if President Perry comes to pass.
Well, if they, I just hope there's enough water for them when they show up.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Clea Pascal.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you. Again, I'm speaking with Clea Pascal, who specializes in geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. Her latest book is Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the political activist, the Reverend Billy. Let it be, let it be. You're there.